Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Iran's supreme leader Ayatollah Khamenei promising retribution, declaring that those responsible for the killing of the top Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps officers at the Iranian diplomatic compound in Damascus, quote, will be punished by our brave men and that they will regret this crime. Iran's foreign minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian also indicated that Iran has sent an important message to the U.S. government, holding it accountable for supporting Israel's actions. Joining us to assess these developments, which suggest Iran may be considering a substantial retaliation, is Nada Hashemi, the director of the Alawite Center for Muslim Christian Understanding and a professor of Middle East and Islamic politics at the Edmund A. Walsh School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University. A non-resident fellow at Democracy for the Arab World Now, he's the author of The People Reloaded, The Green Movement, The Struggle for Iran's Future, and Sectarianization, Mapping the New Politics of the Middle East. Then, with Russia's former Deputy Minister for Energy, Vladimir Milov, warning Putin intends to use oil as a weapon to help elect Trump, we'll look into what Saudi Arabia's crown prince might have in store to hurt Biden's re-election, as we learn that Mohammed bin Salman has had a conversation or conversations with Trump, ostensibly about the LIV golf tour, which is injecting money into Trump's golf courses. Joining us to discuss what Russia and Saudi Arabia could do to jack up the price of gas in the fall ahead of the elections is Jeff Colgan, the Richard Holbrooke Professor of Political Science and Director of the Climate Solutions Lab at the Watson Institute for Public and International Affairs at Brown University, where his research focuses on international order, especially as related to energy and the environment. He's the author of Petroaggression, When Oil Causes War and Partial Hegemony, Oil Politics and International Order. Then finally, with the Secretary of the Treasury in China trying to establish a level playing field in economic relations between the U.S. and China as China's economy falters, while the U.S. has impressive job growth, low unemployment and lowering inflation, we'll discuss how good news might translate into good poll numbers for Biden. Joining us is Robert Hockett, who has had first-hand experience working at the International Monetary Fund and the Federal Reserve Bank of New York and continues to consult for a number of U.S. federal, state, and local legislators and regulators. He drafted Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's Green New Deal resolution for the House of Representatives and officially advises her on economic policy. He's the Edward Cornell Professor of Law and Professor of Public Policy at Cornell University, and his latest books are Money from Nothing or Why We Should Stop Worrying About Debt and Learn to Love the Federal Reserve, Financing the Green New Deal, A Plan for Action and Renewal, and The Citizen's Ledger, Digitizing Our Money and Democratizing Our Finance. And before we begin, I would like to thank our listener donors who keep Background Briefing independent, corporate, and commercial free without paywalls or constant fundraising by making tax-deductible donations to our nonprofit foundation, the Public Truth Media Foundation, at publictruthmedia.org or at backgroundbriefing.org/donate. As we enter this fact-free and violence-prone election year, with much of the country under the cult-like spell of a deranged demagogue spewing constant lies while inciting hatred and violence, help us continue to seek out facts and information to awaken America's silent majority before our democracy is trumped by fascism. And joining us now is Nada Hashemi, the director of the Alawite Center for Muslim Christian Understanding and a professor of Middle East and Islamic politics at the Edmund A. Walsh School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University, a non-resident fellow at Democracy for the Arab World Now. He's the author of The People Reloaded, The Green Movement and the Struggle for Iran's Future, and Sectarianization, Mapping the New Politics of the Middle East. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nada Hashemi.
Thanks, Ian. Good to be with you again.
Well, thanks for joining us, Nada. And there's been a lot of threats of retribution coming from Iran's supreme leader, promising that Israel will be punished by our brave men, that they will regret this crime. The foreign minister of Iran said that he sent an important message to the U.S., holding it accountable for supporting Israel. And Iranian media has been showing pictures of all of their missiles that they say are capable of hitting Iran. And a senior advisor to Iran's supreme leader said that Iran has a legitimate and legal right to strike at Israel's embassies. So what do you expect is going to happen in the next few days or weeks or whenever these threats come to fruition?
Well, I suspect Iran is going to respond to the attack on its diplomatic compound in Damascus, Syria, which, it should be pointed out, killed seven senior Iranian military leaders, three of them high-ranking generals. So the blow to Iran's military presence in Syria was dramatic. This is being compared to the strike on Iran's top general in January 2020 in Baghdad, Qasem Soleimani, who was killed in an American drone strike. So the Iranians are deeply upset because they lost several senior members of their elite military force that is based in Damascus, and they're vowing, you know, to respond. And in many ways, there's a particular logic here in terms of the regional rivalry between Iran and Israel. And it's known as this, it's rooted in this concept of deterrence capacity. If you get hit by your adversary, and if you don't strike back, then you don't establish what's called a deterrent capacity, and that invites further attacks. So this has been the relationship between Israel and Iran going back for a very long time. It's referred to in the literature as this shadow war that has encapsulated the relationship between these two countries. And it remains to be seen how Iran is going to respond. I think part of the dilemma for Iran is that they sense that this is an attempt by Benjamin Netanyahu to take the focus off the disastrous catastrophe unfolding in Gaza and shift the focus to Iran and to other parts of the Middle East and possibly drag the United States into a war. And I suspect Iranian leaders are very much aware of this. Since October the 7th, I think Iran has welcomed the fact that the global spotlight in the Middle East is no longer on its human rights situation within the Islamic Republic, which is catastrophic, and the global focus now is on Israel and, you know, the state-sanctioned war crimes that have been taking place in the Gaza Strip over the last 6 months. So, in one sense, Iran, I think, doesn't want to change that narrative. It benefits from the current narrative, but at the other end of the spectrum, Iran is going to have to respond militarily in some way, because if it doesn't, it's going to invite further attacks. The question is, how will Iran respond and exactly where? And that remains to be seen. I suspect Iran is going to bide its time for a few weeks until it figures out an option that will allow it to respond, to send a message to the West and Israel and the United States in particular that it has deterrence capacity, while doing so in somewhat of a measured way so it doesn't expand into a broader regional war that will then focus global attention on Iran's behavior in the region and away from what Israel is doing in Gaza.
Well, the war in Gaza is not only helping Iran, it's also helping Russia and hurting Ukraine. It's taken the whole focus off the war in Ukraine, off the headlines. But Iran's always had the asymmetrical warfare capability in its proxy, Hezbollah. And I don't think they can, if they pull the trigger on Hezbollah and start raining down missiles on Israel, that will mean that Hezbollah will be destroyed. It happened before. So I can't imagine that Hezbollah's leaders are that anxious to retaliate on behalf of Iran.
No, I agree with that. There are constraints that Hezbollah in Lebanon has to work within, and it's very much a constraint that goes back to the 2006 war that you just alluded to. In 2006, when Hezbollah captured a few Israeli soldiers on the border, provoking a long war that lasted for several weeks, Lebanon was devastated. And the Lebanese blamed Hezbollah for instigating that war. Much of the infrastructure, the economy took a big hit. And if you know what's happening in Lebanon today, it's a very sad and depressing story. The economy is in shambles. The political system is deeply broken. Over 70% of the Lebanese live in poverty. Lebanon cannot sustain and survive, I think, a war with Israel right now, for which Hezbollah will be blamed. And I think we saw an indication of that soon after October the 7th, when the Hezbollah leader, Hassan Nasrallah, basically gave his first speech and said, look, we sympathize with the Palestinians in Gaza, but we're not going to start a war and come to their rescue militarily. So there are deep constraints there. I think Hezbollah will only come into the fight if there's a major attack on Iranian soil and Iran feels that its national security is deeply threatened, then it will probably ask Hezbollah to intervene as a last resort. But barring that, I don't see Hezbollah, you know, responding to recent events in Damascus.
So what restraints are on Netanyahu and the Israeli military? I mean, given the war now in Gaza is past the six-month point, or is at the six-month point, and it's obviously been devastating for Israel diplomatically around the world. And now it seems that pressure from Biden has at least got Netanyahu to send a delegation to Cairo to try and negotiate some kind of settlement, although that's always in doubt. But the argument on the other side, on the pro-war side, if you will, is that the IDF has already mobilized. This is the right time to finish the job and to knock off Hezbollah and the Iranian attacks on the country through its proxies.
I think the restraints on Netanyahu are really what we've been seeing over the last few weeks. Pressure from the United States, pressure from the international community. I think this hit on the World Central Food Kitchen aid workers was a turning point. And then domestically, Netanyahu has a lot of domestic problems, protests, the question of the Israeli hostages, the ability to keep his coalition together. These are all major restraints that I think Netanyahu is struggling with. And I think in many ways they're connected to the attack on Damascus, because Netanyahu knows that if this war ends, he's going to be held accountable for October the 7th. He was in charge of keeping Israel secure, major failure. He also has outstanding court cases that could land him in jail. So it's a complicated picture, and it's unclear to what extent the United States will actually back Netanyahu if he gets into a shooting war with Iran. I don't think the Biden administration in an election year wants to get involved in another Middle East war. I don't think there's no appetite for that here in the United States at the moment. So I think those are the constraints that that exist on the Israeli and the American side as well.
Right, but if Netanyahu needs this war to stay out of jail and to stay in office, and we know that he wants Trump, just as Mohammed bin Salman wants Trump to come back, and Erdogan and Orban and all these crooks around the world, they are all banking on Trump, along with Putin, of course, and they're going to do everything they can to help him. So as far as Netanyahu goes, why not help Trump? Why not hurt Biden?
I agree. I think that very much is the strategy. I think Netanyahu hopes that if he can keep this war going and at least stay in power, keep his coalition together until Trump comes to power, which looks like a possibility, unfortunately, then there's no pressure from the United States anymore. I mean, I just read today that the Republicans in Congress are going to pass some motion strongly condemning Joe Biden for what he said the other day, calling for a ceasefire and sort of putting a little pressure on Israel. So the Republican Party and Donald Trump are solidly, you know, to the right in many ways of Netanyahu. And I think Netanyahu knows this. And if he can just keep things going or drag the United States into some sort of war, that helps him extend his political life.
Right. But that's what I'm worried about. Is that, does he really want to inflame the entire Middle East? Because then the U.S. can't stay out. They get dragged in. There's nothing but lamentable history of U.S. getting dragged in or dragging itself into the Middle East with Iraq and Afghanistan. And now another one, that would be the end of Biden. And just a question of how cynical these people are.
Yeah, that's a good question. I know if you follow the early days after October the 7th, when things were heating up on the Lebanon-Israel border, and there's been several moments over the last 6 months when it looked like things were going to go in a very dark and violent direction across that border, that the United States did intervene to try and restrain Israel and say, look, we don't want this situation in Gaza to expand. There's been a lot of talk, you know, in Israel that, you know, one of the things that could happen or should happen as a result of October the 7th is Israel needs to settle scores finally with its regional adversaries, principally Hezbollah, which poses the biggest, you know, threat on its northern border. So perhaps trying to either provoke Iran or provoke Hezbollah, allowing Israel to deal a strong military, you know, blow to Hezbollah would be something that then Netanyahu can sort of take home and say, look, I protected our northern border. I've significantly diminished or crushed Hezbollah. Now, of course, I think that's very much what Netanyahu and his work cabinet are thinking. Whether Biden is going to sort of, you know, sit on the sidelines and allow this to happen, because this would have huge consequences for, you know, his reelection campaign, that remains to be seen. I don't think that's something Biden and his foreign policy team want. I think they've been trying to constrain Israel. But Netanyahu here is very much desperate. I mean, looking what's happening in Gaza, for example, it's pretty clear that that Israel is locked in a quagmire. It's been 6 months. None of the senior Hamas leadership have been captured or killed. It doesn't look like Israel is going to be able to go into Rafah, given global outrage over what's been happening. And so he's very much stuck in this situation. He can't pull out. He can't, you know, achieve his war aims of crushing Hamas and getting the hostages out. And so we're in this state of, I think, you know, paralysis. And it remains to be seen, you know, what's going to break the logjam here.
Right. But what I fear is maybe he wants to change the subject. I mean, it was, after all, his decision. I'm sure he was behind the decision to hit the Iranian Quds leaders at the consul or the whatever the building was next to the Iranian embassy in Damascus. Now, I'm sure having all those top people at the one spot at the same time was a tempting target for the IDF, but still, you can't help feeling that Netanyahu greenlighted that strike and knew what the consequences would be. So those are the questions that are out there, aren't they, at the moment.
I totally agree. I think he wants to change the subject. I mean, this is the problem with this with this particular topic is that, you know, Israel hits high valued Iranian targets, and then Iran is sort of very tempted to respond for the reasons that I mentioned earlier. And then if Iran does respond, then we start going up the escalatory ladder where one side keeps hitting the other side, and then, you know, one thing can lead to another. We actually saw a replay of this at the end of January, early February, where you might recall one of the militias that Iran backs in Iraq sent a drone to this American base located in Jordan that penetrated the military base and killed three American soldiers. And that then led to a major American military bombing campaign of Iraq and Syria in response. And so when you get into that cycle of violence, of hitting each other's targets, then things can easily get out of hand. And before you know it, we're in a major regional war. I think that's very much Benjamin Netanyahu's calculation. I think that's what he sees as a way of surviving this moment, extending his political career, hoping that something better can come out of this situation that I think is very much being driven, at least at this moment, by Benjamin Netanyahu and his aspirations to extend his political career.
But just in the last couple of minutes there, Nada, the U.S., you mentioned the attack on the U.S. base in Jordan, where the three Americans were killed. The fear at that time was that any major U.S. retaliation could put in jeopardy the U.S. troops in Syria and in Iraq, and it's like about 1,000 in Syria, and I think 5,000, including contractors in Iraq. They're still vulnerable. I mean, that's the situation that's got to have the Biden administration really nervous at the moment. If Iran is going to retaliate in some big way, and they've already warned the U.S. that they're holding them responsible for what's happening in Gaza, then could they strike against the U.S. troops? Are the U.S. troops there hostages in Iraq and Syria?
Oh, I think that's very much one of the options that probably Iran will exercise. It will reactivate its allies in Iraq and Syria to hit those American troops. I think it's probably a low-cost measure that doesn't escalate things beyond Iran's control. But also it sends a message that Iran has deterrence capacity. Recall, after Qasem Soleimani was assassinated in 2020, Iran responded by a missile strike on two American bases in Iraq that injured many Americans, didn't kill any of them, but it came close. And so I suspect Iran is going to do something very similar to go after those American troops in the region. And so I think they're very much on the firing line right now.
Well, Nader, I thank you for joining us here today. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Ian. Stay in touch.
I will. And again, I've been speaking with Nader Hashemi, who's the director of the Alawid Center for Muslim Christian Understanding and a professor of Middle East and Islamic politics at the Edmund A. Walsh School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University, a non-resident fellow at Democracy for the Arab World Now. He's the author of The People Reloaded, The Green Movement of the Struggle for Iran's Future, and Sectarianization, Mapping the New Politics of the Middle East. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into what Russia and Saudi Arabia might have in store to hurt Biden's re-election by jacking up the price of oil in the fall. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Jeff Colgan, who is the Richard Holbrooke Professor of Political Science and the Director of the Climate Solutions Lab at the Watson Institute for Public and International Affairs at Brown University, where his research focuses on international order, especially as related to energy and the environment. He's the author of Petroaggression, When Oil Causes War, and Partial Hegemony, Oil Politics and International Order. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jeff Colgan.
Thanks so much for having me on, Ian.
Well, thanks for joining us, Jeff. And just a couple of days ago, Russia's former Deputy Minister for Energy, Vladimir Milov, warned on CNN that Putin intends to use oil as a weapon to help elect Trump. And there was, in effect, a trial run, if you will, back in the fall of 2022, when Russia and Saudi Arabia drove up oil prices above $5, forcing President Biden to release oil from the U.S. Strategic Petroleum Reserve. And that at that time, Biden was clearly furious. He said there's going to be some consequences for what the Saudis have done with Russia. And Senator Dick Durbin said, let's be candid about this. It's Putin, Saudi Arabia, against the United States. And of course, you could argue that jacking up the prices ahead of the 2022 midterms was effective, in as much as the Republicans captured the House. And to some extent, they've been doing Putin's bidding by cutting off aid to Ukraine and in Russia's war against Ukraine. So how much do you think that is a possible rehearsal for what could happen in the fall of this year?
Well, I do think it's possible. Unfortunately, I think the Saudis and the Russians do have an interest in seeing Trump elected and seeing the end of President Biden's term. I think we should always take what people say about the oil markets with a grain of salt. And so it is not certain by any means that just because, you know, some people are saying this, then it will definitely happen. Or, you know, if the price of oil goes up in the fall, it will be because it was intentionally manipulated by Russia and Saudi Arabia. But nonetheless, I think there are multiple reasons why both Vladimir Putin and the rulers of Saudi Arabia, particularly MBS, the prince, crown prince, who is effectively in charge, those two have very specific reasons why they prefer Trump above President Biden.
Well, back in 2018 midterms, the Saudis seemed to have obliged Trump by lowering the price of oil, by flooding the market, which lowered the price of gas just ahead of the 2018 midterms, did they not?
Yeah, I think the Saudis really like Trump. I've been in the Gulf area. I've spoken with Saudis and Emiratis who both really like the way that Trump thinks about the world in terms of deals and cutting a deal to get things done. And they clearly prefer Donald Trump over Joe Biden for a number of reasons. I think one of them has to do with the fact that Joe Biden has said very clearly that he sees the world right now as something of a contest between democracies and autocracies, and very clearly thinks democracies are the good guys, and that puts Russia and Saudi Arabia on the other side of that divide, which is a bit striking because, of course, the U.S. and Saudi Arabia have this very long-standing 70-year plus relationship, but it is one with certain frictions in it. And then on top of that, you have, of course, the Ukraine war. So Vladimir Putin is kind of counting on a shift in U.S. politics and the small amount of support that the U.S. is now giving, right? So the U.S. has given lots of support to Ukraine, but now that support is really drying up. And he, of course, would love to see the Republicans do well in November and to see Donald Trump in the White House so that that support would trickle down to almost nothing. And so there's a number of different factors that allow Donald Trump to be the preferred candidate. And I should add one more, which is that climate change is a really significant difference between Donald Trump and Joe Biden, right? Joe Biden is saying, look, we have to start weaning the world off of fossil fuels. And he's taking at least some baby steps in that direction, moving the US economy and to a certain extent the world economy farther along that path. And I say baby steps, but I want to point out that the Inflation Reduction Act was a really significant act, the most important climate legislation the US has ever had. It's not enough, but it is a really substantial move. And so you can see why two leaders of petrostates in Russia and Saudi Arabia think, well, this is not good for our long-term business. We don't want to see this guy in power. We want to see somebody like Donald Trump who says, drill, baby, drill, and wants the oil industry to go along like gangbusters and effectively deny that we have a climate change problem at all. And so, for all of these different reasons, right, with Biden's preference for democracies, Biden's view on Ukraine, Biden's view on climate change, this just adds up to a whole lot of reasons why leaders in Russia and Saudi Arabia would want Donald Trump back in office.
But Saudi Arabia and Russia's long-term plans are at the detriment of the planet, right? I mean, in other words, if you pump all the Saudi oil and all the Russian oil, it's the end of the planet.
No question. No question. It is a real problem. And Americans should be concerned about the idea that foreign leaders are manipulating oil markets and other markets in ways to try to impose their views on who should be in the White House. This is something that, countries are ideally supposed to be able to decide themselves who their own leader will be. And this is something that I think Americans don't have a whole lot of sympathy for. And it puts, I mean, for I think most people on the left, this is sort of a very clear decision about what, how to react to this problem. I think for people who are on the right, it's a much more complicated situation where, of course, their sympathies might lie with some of Trump's preferences with respect to, boosting the American oil industry and to, maybe being at least less worried about climate change than the Democrats are. But at the same time, even if those are your political preferences, I don't think too many voters on the right are happy about, Russia and Saudi Arabia having a significant influence on elections by either raising or, as you say, in 2018, lowering the price of gasoline, which affects, we know from, very solid social science research, we know that the price of gasoline affects the mood of voters and therefore their voting intentions and in particular how they react to the incumbents, right? So high gasoline prices are very bad news for incumbent presidents, and to a certain extent, to incumbent congressional leaders as well.
And just to give some figures on what happened back in 2018, when the OPEC Plus group led by Saudi Arabia and Russia decided in June of 2018 to increase production by 1.2 million barrels a day. By November, Saudi production had risen to 11.3 million barrels a day, which is the highest level ever. And at the moment, they're pumping at 9 million barrels a day. So, Jeff, we should also mention that the U.S. is the largest producer of oil on the planet, right? I mean,
Indeed. Absolutely. I mean, it used to be that the US, Saudi Arabia, and Russia were essentially the big three. They were all basically equal in terms of the amount of total oil and gas production they had. But the US, thanks to the sort of the fracking revolution of the last 10 years, has really surged ahead to be kind of sitting atop the world production tables alone. And so there's no question that despite by the Biden administration's kind of concern about the long-term effects of the fossil fuel industry, the fact is that the oil and gas industry has done very well in the last 4 years. And as much as they complain about the Biden administration, if anything, some of this is just kind of the long-term effects, right? So some of the sort of previous decisions made either in the Trump administration or even the Obama administration, affect what's happening in the current oil and gas industry. The truth is that they're making huge profits in the last few years. I do think, we have to think about Russia and Saudi Arabia's economic interests versus their political interests, right? So they, of course, would like the price of oil to be very high because they make money off of it. So they have a pure economic interest in high oil prices. But it's also really notable that both Russia and Saudi Arabia have the kind of budgetary flexibility. They have the economic situation where they can prioritize their political objectives even at the expense of some short-term economic pain. And so even if they didn't think that they wanted the price of oil to be high, for the long term, they might be willing to bear it for a certain number of months because, both of Vladimir Putin and MBS have shown that what they really care about are their strategic objectives and getting what they want done politically. And so that's, I think, the major driver of their energy policy decisions.
So just in the last few minutes, so let's focus on the news that we've just learned that Donald Trump has recently spoken with Mohammed bin Salman of Saudi Arabia. That's and maybe more than one conversation, we don't know, but and we don't know whether they've had other conversations since Trump left office in January of 2021. But ostensibly, apparently, they're talking, supposed to be talking about the Live Gulf Tour, which is a Saudi operation, which is actually pumping money into Trump's golf courses, particularly Doral, which is, he's lost a lot of customers, needless to say, because he's so divisive. He may have a lot of MAGA golfers, but a lot of other golfers have abandoned Trump property. So the Saudis are bailing him out in pumping money into the Live Tour. So what do you make of that? By the way, Trump and the Saudis have an ongoing business relationship in Oman, where they're building a big office complex and hotels and golf courses, etc. So what do you make of the phone call?
It's a really great point, and I'm glad you raised it because you're exactly right that this kind of business relationship between foreign leaders and not only a former president, but a prospective future president is really unusual. It's not something that either the Republicans or the Democrats typically engage in. And in fact, in some ways, it's actually forbidden by the Constitution, right? This is supposed to be something that is off limits because of precisely the either real or perceived conflicts of interest that it generates. That effectively, you could have foreign governments that are offering cash payments to the individual who becomes president to then affect US foreign policy that might be to the detriment to the other 330 million Americans, but profitable to the guy in the White House. And this is exactly the kind of thing that our rules of democracy are supposed to protect us against. And unfortunately, they haven't done a great job, meaning, the legal system hasn't found great ways of holding Donald Trump accountable. I say political and legal system, I should say, holding him accountable, or at least deterring him from engaging in some of exactly these activities that you're talking about.
Well, we also know, of course, that Jared Kushner, the son-in-law of Trump's, got $2 billion from the Saudi Sovereign Wealth Fund over the objections of its the heads of that fund. MBS gave him $2 billion based upon pretty flimsy business record of affinity partners, and then of course Mnuchin got $1 billion as well, the former Treasury Secretary. So the Saudis have been helping out the Trump family big time. Let me just close up with something, though, in terms of a possibility here, Jeff, and that is that during the Trump administration, over the objections of the Homeland Security, that Trump went ahead and allowed the Saudis to buy America's largest oil refinery in Port Arthur, Texas, which is considered critical infrastructure. The deal was closed in 2019. It produces 600,000 barrels of oil a day, and the Saudis could shut that down for maintenance in the fall, could they not?
Yeah, it's really striking that, the oil industry talks about how it provides energy security, and, energy security should be top of mind for legislators and government policymakers. And then things like this happen where you say, well, hang on, what's going on here? If we're serious about national energy security, why are we letting foreign corporations or foreign entities own critical infrastructure in the United States?
Well, that is something to keep our eye on. I thank you very much for joining us here today, Jeff Colgan.
Thanks so much, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Jeff Colgan, who's the Richard Holbrooke Professor of Political Science and the Director of the Climate Solutions Lab at the Watson Institute for Public and International Affairs at Brown University, where his research focuses on international order, especially as related to energy and the environment. And he's the author of Petroaggression, When Oil Causes War, and Partial Hegemony, Oil Politics and International Order. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the good economic news, as well as Secretary of Treasury Janet Yellen's efforts to establish a level playing field in economic relations between the U.S. and China.
I could have built a house on the ocean. I could have placed our love in the sky. But it all really doesn't matter at all. No, it all really doesn't matter at all. Life's a guess. I hope it's gonna last.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Robert Hockett, who has had first-hand experience working at the International Monetary Fund and the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, and continues to consult for a number of U.S. federal, state, and local legislators and regulators. He drafted Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's Green New Deal resolution for the House of Representatives and officially advises her on economic policy. He's the Edward Cornell Professor of Law and Professor of Public Policy at Cornell University, and his latest books are Money from Nothing, or Why We Should Stop Worrying About Debt and Learn to Love the Federal Reserve, Financing the Green New Deal, a Plan of Action and Renewal, and The Citizen's Ledger, Digitizing Our Money, Democratizing Our Finance. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Hockett.
Thanks, Ian. Really great to be with you again.
Well, thanks for joining us. And there was some really good economic news coming out in the last few days. Employers added 303,000 new jobs in March. Unemployment rate fell to 3.8% from 3.9% the month before. Annual wages slowed to 4.1% from 4.3%. That's the lowest in 3 years, but that's offset by the reduction in inflation. So I must say I was amused to see the Maria Bartiromo on Fox News flummoxed by the good numbers and trying to find something wrong with them, exposing the kind of naked propaganda of Fox. But in general, one of the things that puzzles me, though, Robert, is that normally Wall Street doesn't like low unemployment and higher wages. But the stock market shot up with these new figures. That was surprising.
Yeah, I think there may be a couple of things that are worth kind of noting about this, right? So first off, there are always sort of two contrary forces in the market when it comes to the unemployment rate or what have you. On the one hand, when labor compensation is rising, which typically tends to happen, of course, when unemployment is falling because it becomes more a seller's market for labor than a buyer's market, that tends, on the one hand, in the immediate term, to sort of operate to the disadvantage of capitalists, so to speak, right? The people who have to pay these laborers, right? And so you can imagine Wall Street reacting negatively because it means, well, labor is going to be a bit more powerful. It's going to have more bargaining power. That means we capitalists are going to have to pay them more. And it also might even, you know, lead to inflation or something like that. The flip side, however, the reason that Wall Street sometimes reacts, I think, favorably to good labor news is because that usually means that there's going to be continuing strength when it comes to consumer demand in the economy. And that means in turn that there are going to be more profit opportunities when it comes to producing and selling. There's going to be a market for your goods, in other words. And so in that sense, it can be good news. What determines, you know, how the market reacts on any given occasion, whether it treats this as good news or treats it as bad news, I think sort of depends on many, many additional factors. And so it's kind of hard to sort of predict in advance what the reaction is going to be at any given point. But I would speculate at the moment, at least, or I would conjecture that one reason that the market is regarding this overall as good news is that A, there's been some fear that the economy might be, you know, sort of maxing out and we might be headed for, you know, sort of worse employment numbers in the days ahead. And so this is sort of clearly operating contrary to that. And secondly, the markets know now that the Fed is on top of the inflation that sort of broke out in 2021 and to some extent in 2022. They understand that that the Fed is watching. They also, I think, have finally come to realize that it was really a supply-based problem, the inflation, that is to say, rather than an excess money problem. And so now that the supply chains are being sort of restored and now that we're actually producing again in a way that we weren't during the pandemic, there's less danger of inflation than there used to be. So we actually have good employment numbers without the significant inflationary threat that has traditionally been associated with good employment numbers.
Well, one of the things that seems pretty clear to me is that Biden is quite a departure from Obama. And I noticed Larry Summers has been criticizing Obama's spending on jobs and infrastructure and the sky is falling and all this stuff. And he's been proven unbelievably, resoundingly wrong. Mm-hmm. What do you make of that? Biden is not particularly friendly to Wall Street. He marched on a picket line with the UAW, whereas mm-hmm. Obama bent over backwards to be nice to Wall Street and forgave them from what they did in 2008.
Yeah, I remember, you know, in 2008 when Obama won, in the 2 months following the victory before he took office, he was faced with, you know, some fairly important decisions of who was going to be his Treasury Secretary on the one hand and who was going to be his Chief Economic Advisor on the other. And you might recall at the time that on the latter, it was a contest between Joe Stiglitz and Larry Summers. And when it came to Treasury Secretary, it was a choice between Geithner on the one hand and Sheila Bair on the other. And I was sitting there literally in my office, literally praying that that Obama would pick Sheila Bair as his Treasury Secretary and Joe Stiglitz as his Chief Economic Advisor. And of course, he made the contrary picks in both cases. And that pretty much told you, I think, everything you needed to know about what Obama's presidency was going to be like. It was going to be a great disappointment, I think, as far as economic matters were concerned, even if not a complete and utter disaster. And I think Larry Summers is, in effect, the kind of walking sort of dinosaur style reminder of everything that went wrong in the Obama years and also everything that went wrong in the Clinton years for that matter. It's amazing to me that people still pay attention to him. It's amazing to me that he's still even interested in trying to call attention to himself. He must be highly narcissistic to keep calling attention to himself, notwithstanding the fact that it always ends up operating to his not to his benefit, but to the contrary, because he always ends up being wrong. I think that the only valuable thing about Larry Summers these days is he's a perfect predictor, in the sense that anything that he predicts, you just predict the contrary and you're going to be right.
So why then is these good economic numbers not translating politically for Biden? Maybe they will by the time the vote happens in November of this year, but still, there's always been this disconnect between, I mean, and it's not to say that the average citizen doesn't feel the economy is not particularly good for them. And I have to tell you, every time I go to the supermarket, I get sticker shock. I can't believe how prices have doubled on just about everything.
Yeah.
And I don't know, corporate America is getting away with it because it's clearly they took advantage of COVID. And they're just jacking their prices up willy-nilly. And I don't know, is there any mechanism to stop them? Because Biden's getting blamed for the price gouging, from particularly on the price of food, which most people, obviously, it's one of the basic necessities in life. And you just can't help noticing how expensive things have gotten.
Yeah, I think there's sort of, once again, two things at work here. To begin with, there's a bit of a paradox that's effectively unavoidable, in our present circumstance. The paradox is this: Biden, unlike any other candidates other than maybe Bernie Sanders in recent years, has understood that the deeper problems of our economy are deep structural, right? They're very fundamental, very foundational. They're not just sort of superficial on the surface type problems. And, you know, to his credit, he seems to have recognized this. And thus, most of the initiatives that he's been putting forward and pushing, even since the 2020 election, are sort of deep structural reform type proposals or changes. And that's good, right? But here's where the paradox comes in. By definition, those are the kinds of changes that take time to manifest, precisely because they're deep, precisely because they're structural, right? You can, in other words, fix superficial problems very quickly, but you can't fix deep problems quickly. You have to devote sustained attention and follow through to them. And that's, of course, what Biden is doing. But the problem, the sense in which that becomes paradoxical then, is that the benefits of those sort of deep structural investments, as it were, don't pan out until a little bit later, and the time that it might take can indeed be a time that's longer in duration than the electoral cycle. In other words, longer than, say, 4 years or 3 years or what have you. So that's part of the story here. But another part of the story, I think, that you've put your finger right on, is that it's not just a matter of structure at this point. It is partly a matter of opportunism, essentially of exploitation as well. And I think you put your finger right on it. We have all sorts of empirical data that shows that sellers have been, you know, taking advantage of the supply shortages that were caused by COVID by jacking up prices and keeping them up even after the original supply problems have been, you know, have abated, have been addressed and solved. And so we do have, I think, a significant element then of essentially price gouging still underway. And there's sort of good news for Biden. You can address things like that more quickly. In other words, you can address things like that and not have to wait for 4 or 5 or 6 years for the benefits to come about. You can address them immediately, but you have to get a bit tough, right? You have to sort of essentially deploy the Department of Justice and all of your other antitrust officials against the price gougers. You have to, you know, essentially engage in law enforcement in a big way. And you have to call it out too. You have to use your sort of bully pulpit to point to it and get the public to be attending to it and essentially, you know, whip up public outrage about it. Now, if Donald Trump can whip up public outrage against people who happen to be brown complected or happen to, you know, speak Spanish as their second or first language, I don't see why Biden can't whip up more justified public anger and even outrage at price gouging. If he were to do that, I think he would basically solve the one remaining sort of lingering problem that he's going to be entering into the next election sort of facing.
So let's talk about the relationship with China, which is obviously tense. And Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen is in China. She had meetings on Friday, a long 3-hour meetings with the Vice Premier Li Feng. And the U.S. is actually very concerned that cheap Chinese green energy technology, such as solar panels and electric vehicle batteries, are hurting Biden's efforts to electrify the economy and to get rid of you know, get rid of the internal combustion engine and deal with global warming, all of which is necessary. But the U.S. feels that it has to have its own industrial base working, particularly producing solar panels and batteries. And the Chinese, of course, are selling both solar panels and electric car batteries below the cost. And they've got huge inventories now. They can't even sell the panels and batteries that they've produced. So you can understand why the U.S. wants to be able to self-sufficient in that regard, not entirely dependent upon China for the new green economy. But how are they going to navigate this?
Yeah. So once again, I think there's a sort of a micro aspect to this and a macro aspect. The micro aspect is, you know, quite simple, right? If you're trying to jumpstart your own industries or revive your own industries or bring them back, then you do have to protect them, as any developing country, including the United States in the 19th century, can attest, right? This is the old infant industry idea, the idea that those who are already established in a particular industry are able to kill you before you can even grow unless you are in some way protected. And we in the U.S. tend to think of ourselves as no longer an infant industry country. We think of ourselves as already industrialized, but that's sort of false now because we're really post-industrialized. We let our actual industries, of course, get hollowed out and disappear over the course of the 1990s and after. And so we're now kind of where we were in the early 19th century again. We're a developing economy again, in a sense, in that all of the new industries of the future of the 21st century and beyond, all of the green industries, those are new industries, and we don't already have a major presence in them in the way that China does. So in a way, we are related to China now in the way that we were related to Great Britain in the 19th century. And that means we have to protect the now de facto infant industries here if we want them to grow. And so that's the micro point. And I don't think we should be ashamed of that at all. I think Biden should just be forthright and say, we have to protect our own industries until we grow them to scale in the way that we did in the 19th century. There's a bigger point here, however, as well, a macro point. And it's really contained in that irony, right, where we're complaining about a country that is so, you know, so massively producing the very technologies that we need to save the world, that you know something's got to be screwed up here, right? There's something messed up if what anybody would ordinarily think of as a good thing has to be decried as a bad thing. It's a variation on what John Maynard Keynes referred to back in the 1930s during the Great Depression as the paradox of poverty in the midst of plenty. Here's the basic problem. The basic problem, it seems to me, is the way we have organized production since the 19th century is we allow a very small number of our population to own all of the productive assets. And then they rent the other 99% of us to labor for them, right? Anybody who works for wages or salaries is essentially a human rental, right? A person who is rented by somebody who owns the machinery or the factory space or whatever where the people work. And the reason that that can be a problem under current circumstances is that it means there's no direct connection between the prospering of 99% of us on the one hand and the productivity of our factories and productive facilities on the other hand. There's no direct connection to that, between that. So we have to depend on other people to employ us and depend on our own industries being big enough to employ us. And so we have to be horrified when somebody else outproduces us like China. What if, though, on the other hand, what we did instead of complaining about overproduction was to essentially ensure that massive production benefited everybody by essentially ensuring that everybody had ownership stakes in the firms that do the producing. In other words, if our firms in the United States were owned by labor itself, or if they were at the very least sort of co-determined in the German way by labor and capital alike, by saying at least 50% of all corporate boards had to be chosen by labor rather than by capital, then, of course, you could have a situation where no working person could possibly fail to benefit by or be threatened by so-called overproduction, right? Anytime you have a potential overproduction problem, which is a common problem in the 19th century, it's a sign that your ownership relations are screwed up. You don't actually, the way that you conduct production in your country and the way you distribute ownership of the actual productive facilities and productive assets is itself screwed up, right? So one of the big projects I've been working on of late for Congressman Khanna, who we've talked about before, is putting together what I call an economic democracy plan for him, which is essentially involve public subsidization and assistance to employee buyouts of their own firms, rendering importation from other countries contingent on laid off American workers being compensated with ownership stakes in the firms that disemploy them, and so on and so forth. We can talk in more detail on that later when my book on this comes out, as we've talked about before, but that's the basic idea.
Right, but just in closing, Robert, you have to change the culture, the business culture in this country, where the capitalist class, the managers, going back to the business schools, they teach them, you know, slash and burn, take no prisoners, all these sort of aggressive metaphors to grind your workers down. There's this tremendous cultural difference between the rich and the poor, and it grows. And look at the way the billionaires, and a lot of them don't like Trump, but they're basically going to back him because he's going to cut their taxes. And the Trump tax cuts, which were so generous to the 1% of the 1%, they expire next year, so they want Trump around because he's transactional, whereas Biden's not going to renew the tax cuts. So that's you got to tell these people who are making it like bandits that it's time for them to be a little more patriotic and understand that what is it Jack Kennedy said, a rising tide raises all boats.
Yeah. No, I think that's right, Ian. I mean, you do have to tell them that. But of course, you can't just tell them that. You have to back it up with law, right? You have to sort of enact laws, and you have to pursue programs that don't give them the choice, right, to sort of prevent our democratizing our economy. And I think a way to do this rhetorically, or at least the rhetorical complement to these particular legal measures that I think we have to take, is essentially to use the democracy idea. Nobody in this day and age would tolerate the idea of an oligarchy politically running the country, right? And nobody would tolerate a legislature that isn't like nominally chosen by the people. But why is it that our productive lives are any different? Why do we allow dictatorship when it comes to production while insisting on democracy when it comes to government? Most of us spend the greater part of our lives and even identify ourselves by reference to our particular vocations and our jobs.
Why but the plutocrats are taking over both, Robert. Yeah. They've already got the production and industrial situation sewn up, and they've taken over the Supreme Court, and they're taking over the legislatures. And if they bring back Trump, they'll have the whole plutocratic ball game.
Exactly. And the one enables the other, right? It's because of the lack of economic democracy that we can't sustain political democracy. If we insisted on and fought for economic democracy, then political democracy would be a lot easier to keep, right? Because you wouldn't have plutocrats who are able to buy politicians and buy Supreme Court justices and the like.
Well, Robert Hockett, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks so much, Ian. Really great to be with you as always.
And again, I've been speaking with Robert Hockett, who's had firsthand experience working at the International Monetary Fund and the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. And he continues to consult to a number of U.S. federal, state, and local legislators and regulators. He drafted Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's Green New Deal resolution for the House of Representatives and officially advises her on economic policy, and is the Edward Cornell Professor of Law and a Professor of Public Policy at Cornell University. His latest books are Money from Nothing, or Why We Should Stop Worrying About Debt and Learn to Love the Federal Reserve, Financing the Green New Deal, A Plan of Action and Renewal, and The Citizen's Ledger, Digitizing Our Money, Democratizing Our Finance. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Evan Green to help us sustain this program into the future and ensure it remains free to all. Please take a moment to support us by going to backgroundbriefing.org/donate or publictruthmedia.org, where you will find our nonprofit Public Truth Media Foundation, where your tax-deductible donations, large and small, keep us broadcasting. And if you've missed any of today's programs or would like to explore our vast archives, you can find us at backgroundbriefing.org, where we include extended interviews searchable by topic and have made it easy for you to sign up for daily email updates that provide links to resources, articles, and books discussed on the program. Also, you can find links there to subscribe wherever you get your podcast, and we encourage your ratings and reviews on these platforms. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at Ian Masters Media, and please do help us reach more listeners by sharing this program with friends, family, and colleagues. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. The guy that lived next door in 305.